This may be one of the few weeks of the year that we get a kind of free pass from the national preoccupation with dieting. That is, unless you follow Food Network star Paula Deen. She's raised a big tent for folks who like the idea of live and let live. But as NPR's Allison Aubrey learned, her fans aren't just drawn to her cheese grits with extra butter. There's something more elusive that they're after.
I spend a lot of time interviewing people who are trying to make us and the food we eat healthier. And then there's Paula Deen. When I heard she was coming to town, the image I got in my head was a deep fried cheesecake. She actually does that. So who is this woman?
Now, the first dish I'm going to start with this morning is a spicy cinnamon cake.
This is Paula from an episode of her TV show. She's wearing her pajamas and cooking from her home in Savannah. She loves all the stuff we're supposed to be eating less of.
For this recipe, I'm going to need butter, sour cream, eggs.
She finds a way to sneak mayonnaise into recipes, and she's a fan of tricks to keep things simple, such as adding instant pudding.
And one more ingredient that's going to make this real, real moist.
Sour cream. So is it these easy-peasy recipes?
It has a wonderful, wonderful flavor.
That compel thousands of her fans to buy tickets and wait in lines to see her perform live?
Oh, believe me, it's going to be great. Everybody's going to be so excited and going absolutely insane.
Paula fan Rona Schwartz drove from Philadelphia down to the Metropolitan Cooking Show in D.C. earlier this month to see her live.
I can't wait. I mean, she just has that great smile. You can't help but fall in love with her. You just can't help it.
I was hearing this over and over and over again.
She's awesome. She's sweet. She's cute. She cooks everyday food. I can relate to her.
From Linda Fortunata to Michelle Morgan.
She makes this amazing apple pie.
Apple pie? Really? Doesn't everyone have a yummy recipe for apple pie? But as the spotlight came on, all eyes followed Paula's entrance on stage.
The queen of Southern cooking, the number one lady you came to see.
It started to dawn on me. It's more than the recipes. Paula, with her big blue eyes and her snowy white hairdo, she gives people a connection, a soulful connection they're looking for.
And her fifth year here in Washington, D.C., Paula Deen!
Within moments, Paula's laughing and telling stories, as she does on her TV show. She talks about her two sons and about meeting her second husband.
I remember when Michael and I, well, a few months after we'd been seeing each other, I got up and I fixed him breakfast.
As Paula talks, James Hampel says it feels like she's speaking just to him. It's as if each of the 2,000 people in the audience have pulled a chair right up to her kitchen table.
She's so homey and, like, she makes me feel like I'm in grandma's kitchen. Like, she just, like, I just want to hug her.
At one point, she invites the whole audience to come along on her annual winter cruise. Julie Cook, who's been, says it's a hoot.
She'll sit down right with you at the table and probably pick off your plate. But people get to know her intimately. She learns people's names and becomes friends with them.
Charisma aside, the part of Paula Deen's personal story that many diehard fans connect with is her triumph over big struggles, including a bad first marriage and agoraphobia, an anxiety disorder that left her afraid to leave her house.
It's tremendously inspiring to be a person who can overcome something like agoraphobia.
Food anthropologist Christine Dubois says in an age when conditions such as ADD, OCD, PTSD are part of the national lexicon, the ability to conquer one becomes the 21st century pull yourself up from the bootstraps story that gives people hope.
If Paula Deen could do it and become this incredible phenomenon, maybe I should have the courage to overcome my difficulties too.
So what's Paula's next personal dragon to slay? Well, when I caught up with her after the live show, she told me that to compensate for her love of rich food, she'd like to start exercising.
I've heard that about exercise, that it is addictive.
She told me that her son Bobby is hooked.
So I've got to see if I can't get myself addicted.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank
I really
you,
appreciate
dear.
It.
You You're so welcome.
Thank you.
You're cute, and I love those little ear screws.
Oh, she's got me. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Here with me now is Flora Lichtman with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
What have we got this special holiday week?
This is a moldy oldie that we're digging out of the archives, but it's actually a really good one. And it's perfectly appropriate for the day after Thanksgiving, because mm-hmm. if you, like I am feeling like a large pumpkin right now
after my meal. As big as a large pumpkin, yeah.
Then this video is for you. This is a large pumpkin grower, these Atlantic giants. They're these pumpkins that get to be 1,000 pounds. And we go visit Robert Sabin, who lives out in Long Island, and is entering his giant pumpkin into the Hicksville Giant Pumpkin Weigh-Off.
Wow. And it's a big competition, isn't it? People come from around the country.
People from around Long Island, for sure, with their giant pumpkins. But there's a parade of giant pumpkins, and we hear how they grow the pumpkins. Robert Sabin has amazing stories about what he's done to protect his pumpkin. So first of all, he has this whole pumpkin patch in his backyard, and he eventually settles on the pumpkin that he's going to put all of his care into. And then he does things like he puts a blanket on it at night.
Oh, so really?
Cute. Really? I couldn't make this up. I mean, to keep it warm at night, and you can't overwater it. This is a big problem people have because the skin will crack. So you have to be, a considerate parent. Mm-hmm. But you can't eat them. My first question was like, oh, pumpkin pie forever. And he was like, no, that's not what these are for.
and it weighs almost 1,000 pounds. You have to get it out of the backyard.
Crane.
Right?
Yep. You get it. This is actually a really tense moment for these pumpkin growers, is getting it out of the patch, into the truck, and then loading it back onto the scale at the weigh-off. So you see them coming through in cranes. It shouldn't be missed. It's really a feel-good hero story.
And it's our video pick of the week. It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. A feel-good pumpkin story.
Yes, that's right.
A success, something make you feel.
All
it's
pumpkin
uplifting.
Stories are feel-good, but
that's it.
It is uplifting. Yes.
It's uplifting, and he's uplifting the pumpkin, and you'll see that right there in the video on our video pick of the week. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
The Arab League meets today in Cairo to consider imposing sanctions against Syria after Damascus rejected the League's demand that Syria allow an observer mission into the country. As protests there continue and the death toll mounts, neighboring Turkey says that it's ready to join the Arab League in levying punitive measures against the government in Damascus. But as NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Istanbul, Turkey's deep reluctance to endorse a military option underscores the complex risks surrounding any foreign intervention in Syria.
Once Turkey got over its fear of losing lucrative business and trade ties with Syria, the anti-Syrian rhetoric escalated rapidly. This week, Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad must step down, in remarks laced with references to some of the 20th century's most notorious dictators.
Bashar al-Assad çıkıyor. Ölene kadar savaşırım diyor.
Bashar al-Assad says, "I'll fight to the death." But for God's sake, who are you fighting? Fighting your own people isn't heroism. It's cowardice. Look at Hitler, Mussolini, Romania's Ceausescu. If that's not lesson enough, look at the Libyan leader. Killed in a way no one would wish. He used the same words you're using.
The capture and killing of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi may have re-energized protesters in Syria, as this video posted on the internet yesterday shows, but it has done nothing to push Turkey or any other country over the line to endorsing intervention. Syrian activists have found a relatively safe haven in Turkey in recent months, including the defected Syrian army officer who claims to lead the opposition Free Syrian Army. Arms are trickling across the Lebanese border, and recent death tolls have included more Syrian security forces. Opposition activists say the Free Syrian Army is trying to protect civilian lives, something they've urgently requested from the international community. But Turks refuse to publicly entertain proposals such as a no-fly zone or a humanitarian corridor. Deputy Prime Minister Bülent Arınç made that clear to a Turkish television station this week.
Not only will Turkey not intervene in Syria, we won't accept any foreign intervention that Turkey is in any way involved with. There is a government that is oppressing its people, and we have fulfilled our responsibility by warning that regime that it must move to democracy.
Turkish sanctions could do significant economic damage to Syria. But analysts such as Turkey scholar Henry Barkey at Lehigh University have noted that a trade embargo or border closing would also harm Turks and further jeopardize Ankara's efforts to reduce Turkey's current account deficit. Military intervention is in another league altogether in terms of risks and unwanted consequences. Syria analyst Peter Harling with the International Crisis Group, in an internet conversation from Cairo, said Damascus is slowly growing more isolated. But there's still no comparing it with Libya, because while evidence on the ground of Iranian assistance in Syria is scarce, Harling says there's a high risk that a foreign military intervention could trigger a sharp retaliation from both Tehran and its proxies, such as the Hezbollah militia in Lebanon.
The problem with Syria is that the Syrian regime is not isolated as the Libyan regime was. Declaring war to this regime essentially means declaring war to the Axis as a whole, comprised of Syria, Hezbollah, and Iran.
But as the bloodshed grows, more than 3,500 dead by the latest UN estimate earlier this month, pressure is also likely to grow for more direct action. Turkey, with its long mountainous border, will continue to be a favored location for an opposition safe haven. Whether to move such a proposal beyond the discussion phase may be one of the most important Mideast policy decisions facing world leaders in the coming months. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
Diabetes affects a large number of Americans and requires them to make difficult lifestyle changes, especially when it comes to food. But there's a performance artist who's made it his mission to make those changes not only tolerable, but life-affirming and delicious. Reporter Yowei Shaw has the story.
He's called Mero Cocinero. That's loosely Spanish for best cook in the kitchen. Mero wears a white chef's hat and red apron, but he's no ordinary culinarian. For one, he only cooks using the plate method, a visual meal planning practice used by the American Diabetes Association that recommends 50% vegetables, 25% starch, and 25% protein. For another, here's how he wants you to chop onions.
I say use the pivot. And what I do is I think of something that makes me upset. So, I can't believe that guy cut me off on the freeway! Like that.
The half-Iranian, half-Guatemalan cook is the creation and alter ego of San Francisco-based performance artist Robert Karimi. In his new project touring the country, Diabetes of Democracy.
He is the best parts of me. He's the superhero. Robert Karimi is Clark Kent and Mero Cocinero is Superman.
Mero is fighting the forces of type 2 diabetes, one live cooking performance at a time. He shows up with his portable kitchen in the unlikeliest of places, from art galleries and theaters to supermarkets and public spaces. He'll do whatever it takes.
I've got knives, wooden spoons here aplenty. I've got banners and leaflets galore.
He'll sing, he'll dance, he'll tell stories and poems and use video art, all in the name of getting you to cook and eat what Meadow promises to be delicious, diabetic-friendly food.
I want to be where the Iron Chefs are. I want to see Emerald cooking.
It all started around 10 years ago, when Karimi's Iranian-American dad was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes.
He chose not to take insulin. He refused it. He hated it.
His father was able to manage the disease with more exercise and going back to the healthier Persian recipes of his youth. But it was a wake-up call for Karimi, a lifelong fast food junkie. He got scared and asked a nutritionist for advice.
When she said to me that one of the first things when someone finds out they're diabetic says is, what did I do wrong? That changed me as an artist. Like, I started writing scripts and ideas about that. What did I do wrong? You know, oh, is it because of all the tortillas I ate? Like, that's horrible.
Karimi also found that there seemed to be a one-diet-fits-all approach to dealing with diabetes that didn't appeal to him.
And I'm like, you don't have to get rid of the tortillas. You just have to see how it fits within this plate. How many carbs is that? How many tortillas? Maybe you can't have six. Maybe you can't have, you know, maybe one.
So he came up with a strategy. Use his cooking show to get himself and others to connect with cultural traditions involving food. And do it with a low-glycemic, distinctly fun flavor. But does it actually work? I went to check out Karimi's cooking show at a monthly gathering of food trucks on Baltimore's Inner Harbor to see for myself.
We're just going to make it a big party. Are you cool with that?
So cool with that.
Yes, because it's Friday night, right?
Yeah.
In a sea of gourmet grilled cheese sandwiches, crepes, and cupcakes, Mero was serving a menu of tomato chutney, chocolate avocado mousse, spicy popcorn, and later, a really big dance party.
DJD Double is trying to fix it.
The speakers went out?
Yes.
Well, that was before the speakers went out. And that wasn't all. The venue didn't have lights, and they hadn't brought any. So Mero switched to plan B.
Chocolate mousse.
All right.
No, not you.
Come on.
Yeah!
Chocolate mousse.
There you go, there you go.
Oh, lordy.
Oh, lordy.
He went straight out into the crowd, giving away samples and getting people to guess what the secret ingredients were.
What do you think? What do you think?
Cream.
Cream?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Avocado.
What?
Avocado.
That is delicious.
Chocolate, agave, and vanilla.
Wow, that is delicious.
And a little cayenne. See?
When I asked Creamy if he thinks this project is really going to get people to change, he said it's hard to know for sure. Sometimes audience members will email him for recipes and come to see him perform again with their friends and family. At the very least, it's working for Karimi. He's lost 14 pounds since the project started. And no, he didn't have to deprive himself of all things delicious. Let me tell you, that did not taste like diet food. For NPR News, I'm Yowei Shaw.